John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, September 28, 2011. Local guards foil a settler attack in Hebron, and Israel to confiscate land near Hebron to build the bypass road. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. The local guard committees foiled on Tuesday night an attack by Israeli settlers that targeted the Palestinian residents of Tel Urmeida in Hebron. Around 100 settlers gathered and toured from Shuhada Street and other neighborhoods in Hebron and headed to Tel Urmeida. Dozens of Palestinian volunteers gathered to stop the settlers, however the settlers fled the scene. The local guards committees are groups of Palestinian volunteers who try to guard their cities and villages from settler attacks. Youth Against Settlements, an active group in Hebron, organized the local guard committees in the city. The youth patrolled the city day and night to keep watch of the people there. A number of local guard committees have been organized in several Palestinian cities, towns, and villages, especially those adjacent to Israeli settlements, as a result of the increased number of settler attacks against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank. The Israeli military informed on Tuesday the local council of Beit Umar, north of Hebron, of their plans to build a bypass road that will go through some of the town's land. According to the spokesman of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements, Muhammad Awad, the Israeli government will confiscate 200 acres of land for the sake of the planned road. Awad said the military is planning to start building the road in less than 1 week, which doesn't give the residents a chance to object and appeal to the courts to stop the land confiscation. The Popular Committee called the residents to nonviolently resist the Israeli plans, which will affect the lives of dozens of Palestinian families who will lose their land, which is their main source of income. In other news, Palestinians detained in Israeli jails have announced on Wednesday the beginning of an open-ended hunger strike to demand an end to the ever-increasing humiliating and degrading treatment by the Israeli administration of the jails. The prisoners also demand the administration to end the solitary confinement of a number of prisoners, some of which has been in for 10 years. There are currently around 8,000 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The United Nations Security Council will submit the Palestinian membership application to a special committee at the UN to evaluate the application. Riyad Mansour, the Palestinian representative at the UN, said this committee is of a great importance and the meetings will be attended by representatives from all member states, in addition to ambassadors of some other countries. Mansour said it is not confirmed yet that the Palestinian bid will have 9 votes in the council, although all the 9 member countries recognize Palestine individually. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas submitted the full UN membership application to the UN Secretary General on September 23rd before his speech before the UN General Assembly, which is said to be unprecedented by a Palestinian leader in such a world forum. That was just some of the news from Palestine today. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imenc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Katsis and me, George Rishmal.
Afghanistan, yesterday or today. The AP Wire is reporting that a New Zealand Special Forces soldier was killed during a gun battle with suspected insurgents in a compound near Kabul. Afghanistan, yesterday. The Taliban killed 8 police in an attack in Lashkargah, Helmand Province, and injured 3. Apparently one of them was a Taliban double agent who fled with the attackers. Baghdad, yesterday late. 4 bombings, 2 of them car bombs, killed 3 people and wounded 13. Baghdad, Iraq, today. Gunmen wearing Iraqi army uniforms killed 5 members of a Sawa or Awakening militia member's family, wounded 7 in a home invasion in Abu Ghraib by one report. In what appears to be a description of the same incident, Aswat al-Iraq puts the location in a village near Fallujah. This must be the same incident because the casualty toll and other details are identical. The Sawa, or Awakening fighters, were former insurgents who changed sides in 2007 to side with the Americans and are regarded by many in the country as traitors. Kukuk, Iraq, yesterday. 2 armed fighters were killed in a firefight with a joint Iraqi-U.S. force while allegedly trying to plant an explosive charge in Taza Kumaru Township, 20 kilometers south of Kukuk, early on Wednesday, Kukuk's police director reported, according to the Aswat al-Iraq news agency. Wait a minute. What joint U.S.-Iraqi patrol? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh yeah, that's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, U.S. troops are supposed to be out of Iraq in 3 months and they're still doing this sort of thing? Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home from both Iraq and Afghanistan today. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
Cambodia's President Hun Sen, facing a cutoff of World Bank development loans, has agreed to set aside land in the capital city of Phnom Penh for people evicted to make way for a Chinese-financed luxury development. In mid-August, under growing pressure from housing activists opposed to the massive Bong Kok Lake project to build high-end housing and shops, the World Bank voted to cut loans for new development projects. However, the World Bank will continue to fund $350 million in existing health and education projects in Cambodia, one of Asia's poorest countries. Reuters reports over 15,000 city residents have already been evicted from their homes to make way for the Chinese-financed housing and shopping development. Land seizures that result in homelessness are among Cambodia's most pressing human rights issues. Property deeds and other land records were mostly destroyed under the Khmer Rouge's genocidal regime in the late 1970s. According to the Guardian newspaper, housing groups in Cambodia say residents in the development zone are denied due process in eviction claims or asserting property rights in violation of World Bank policy. Each year in Cambodia, an estimated 30,000 people are forced to move off their land to make room for real estate development, mining, and agricultural projects.
On the 24th of September, during the fall meetings of the IMF and World Bank in 2011, protesters showed up with complete and total surprise outside the Washington Circle Hotel, where members of press confirmed that IMF and World Bank delegates were staying. The protesters were there in solidarity with anti-austerity protesters in Greece, in Portugal, and with Occupy Wall Street in New York City. On the same day, police in New York attacked Occupy Wall Street with orange nets and mass arrests, tactics not seen since the 2004 Republican National Convention. Furious with the banksters who benefit from this kind of aggression, D.C. protesters who normally focus on animal rights came after the IMF and World Bank delegates at the Washington Circle Hotel.
Good evening, delegates of the World Bank! We know you're here residing at the Washington Circle Hotel! We are here to tell you to make sure that the Greece and Portugal loans must not be paid! The people of Greece and Portugal should not have to deal with austerity programs and social costs and higher taxes. This is unacceptable.
Greece and Portugal.
Sovereign to fall.
Greece and Portugal.
Sovereign to fall.
Greece and Portugal.
Sovereign to fall.
Greece and Portugal.
Sovereign default.
Sovereign
default.
Sovereign default.
Buildings.
Arms up and drop back. It's time you to stop recalling bombs and putting countries into more and more debt, trying to take them over. It's time for you to stop. Because we'll be back.
We'll be back.
Ellen Foster, a former fraud investigator for Countrywide Financial, was fired by Bank of America soon after its takeover of the ailing mortgage giant. In 2007, Foster led an investigation in the Boston area where she shut down six Countrywide offices and fired dozens of employees for committing fraud. In early 2008, Foster was promoted after exposing an effort to cover up fraud at Countrywide. But in September 2008, Foster was fired by Bank of America for unprofessional conduct. 3 years later, she won her job back and received a damage award of $930,000 from the U.S. Department of Labor. Earlier in 2008, Foster disclosed that several workers at Countrywide were transferred or fired for trying to blow the whistle on Nashville loan officer Michael Eckert, who was committing fraud. After that disclosure, members of Foster's team were questioned by Countrywide executives. Foster was fired after she refused to sign a gag order preventing her from talking about what she knew about Countrywide. According to the Center for Public Integrity, Foster was replaced by Larry Goebel, a former Los Angeles Police Internal Affairs investigator who discovered continued fraud by salespeople trying to survive in a collapsing mortgage market. Bank of America paid a stiff price for buying Countrywide Financial. The bank recently signed an $8.5 billion settlement over abuses by the company and faces a $20 billion lawsuit over charges of using fake foreclosure documents to push homeowners out of their houses.
When President Obama outlined his plan on September 19th to raise $1.5 trillion in new taxes, primarily targeting the wealthy to reduce the nation's deficit over the next decade, Republican politicians and conservative activists were quick to brand the president's plan as class warfare. The White House proposal would add $800 billion in revenue from ending the Bush-era tax cuts on households with an annual income of more than $250,000 and gain an additional $700 billion from closing tax loopholes and deductions. Responding to his conservative critics, Obama rejected the class warfare label and stated that after a decade of unchecked spending, every American has to pitch in and pay their fair share. Otherwise, the president maintained, the country will be forced to cut programs benefiting the middle class and poor while protecting tax cuts for the wealthy. He also invoked the so-called Buffett rule, which was coined after billionaire Warren Buffett complained that he shouldn't pay a lower rate in taxes than his secretary. Republicans have long advocated their so-called trickle-down philosophy, which asserts that giving tax breaks to America's wealthiest citizens creates jobs for the rest of the country, a claim challenged widely by many economists. Your reporter spoke with Richard Wolff, professor of economics at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. He examines the dubious right-wing charge of class warfare in light of the major reductions in taxes on the wealthy and corporations, resulting in growing income inequality in recent decades.
If you go back to the 1940s and 50s, roughly half a century ago, you would notice very quickly that taxes on business and taxes on rich people were much, much higher than they are today. I can give you two quick examples. At the end of World War II, for every dollar that Washington got by taxing individuals in the United States, it got $1.50 from business. In other words, the business community paid 50% more of Washington's revenue than the individuals in America did. Today, the same relationship is quite different. For every dollar that Washington gets from individuals, it gets 25 cents from business. And that means that over the last 50 years, the business community in America has been stunningly successful in shifting the burden of taxes off of itself onto individuals. At the same time, among individuals, it's even more dramatic. In the 1950s and 60s, the income tax rate on the richest Americans was 91%. And for every dollar that a rich American earned in the 50s and 60s, over the cutoff point around $100,000, that rich person had to give 91 cents of that dollar to Washington and was only allowed to keep 9 cents for himself or herself. Even as late as the 1970s, the tax bracket, the tax rate on the richest Americans was 70%. For every dollar over $100,000 that a rich American earned, he or she had to give Washington 70 cents. They got to keep only 30. Let me compare that to the way it is now. In 2011, the richest Americans pay an income tax rate of 35%. That's right. For every dollar over roughly $100,000, a rich person today gives Washington only 35 cents and keeps the other 65 cents for himself or herself. Over the last 50 years, taxes have been shifted from business to individuals and from the richest individuals to the middle and the poor in the United States. So I would call that class war, just like my conservative friends do. The only difference is I can show that it's been a massive war conducted over half a century and much larger in its impact on the mass of people than anything Obama has proposed in reverse. In fact, all Obama is proposing to do is to recover a very small portion of what the middle and lower income portions of American society have lost in this class war over the last 50 years.
Professor Wolff, another pet slogan that the right has repeatedly used to attack any kind of progressive taxation is the term redistribution of wealth. They accused Barack Obama of that during the 2008 campaign. The changes in tax rates over recent decades, how does that redistribute wealth in our country towards the wealthy and away from working families and the poor?
What I find striking is the ability of the conservatives and the business community to talk about redistribution as if they are the victims rather than the perpetrators. It's stunning. 30 years ago, in the 1970s and 80s, the United States was a less unequal economy than that of any other major industrial country. In other words, the gap between rich and poor in the United States, say in 1970, was less than the distance between rich and poor in places like England or France or Germany or Italy and so on. Today, that situation has been completely reversed. That is, the rich have become much, much richer, and the mass of the Americans have become somewhat poorer. In other words, the United States now is the most unequal of the advanced industrial countries in the world. And so the bottom line is, unless you want to think of it as purely coincidental, the last 30, 40 years during which taxes on rich people and businesses have been reduced has also been the time when the distribution of wealth in the United States was shifted from middle and low-income people to those at the top who have done the best over the last 30 or 40 years by a wide margin, not only because of the stock market boom and the stagnant wages in the United States, but also because of the change in the tax burden. So that, again, when Obama is charged with a very modest effort to go back a little on the redistribution that has happened, the right wing screams redistribution as if they haven't been the beneficiaries of a much bigger and longer lasting redistribution for the last 30 years.
That was Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, now a visiting professor at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. His latest book is titled Capitalism Hits the Fan. Find links to Professor Wolff's and other articles examining class warfare on our website at btlonline.org.
If you get your news from the mainstream media, you might not have heard yet of Occupy Wall Street. In New York City, protesters descended on the area around the New York Stock Exchange on Saturday, the 17th of September, and have been there ever since. Just like the occupation of Tahrir Square in Egypt. Protesters have been based out of a nearby park which has been renamed Liberty Square and is being held 24 hours a day. The police have responded by closing the portion of Wall Street around the primary target, the New York Stock Exchange. Now the banksters have to pass through police checkpoints to get to work there, just like during an IMF meeting here. The difference is, this will go on for weeks, months, the schedule goes well into next year. The first few days saw some ugly police brutality, including a cop sitting on someone's chest while an asthma attack nearly choked him to death on Tuesday, the 20th of September.
I can't breathe! Oh, wow. He can't breathe! I cannot breathe! He can't breathe! Ah. He can't breathe! Get off him! Get off him! He can't breathe! Look at this!
Saturday, the 24th of September, however, saw the worst police brutality against protesters in New York in years as the NYPD tried and failed to stop the protests. At one point, as the New York pigs were in the street, marching in a line carrying the orange construction fencing they were going to use to pen up protesters, and protesters didn't right away realize what was about to happen, suddenly you could hear one of the senior cops yelling, "Hey guys, everybody lock somebody up."
Everybody lock somebody up.
It's a little hard to hear, so here it is again. That was just before the New York pigs on the 24th of September stretched out orange construction netting around a bunch of women in the Occupy Wall Street protest and arrested everybody inside. Any bystanders would be trapped with the protesters, just like they did during the 2004 Republican National Convention in which George W. Bush was renominated. Between 80 and 100 people were arrested in all for nothing more than being in the area of the protest. Next, a New York cop named Anthony Bologna suddenly opened fire with pepper spray or mace, hitting at least five women in the penned-up area. Anthony Bologna, you're a stinking piece of New York pig shit. Here is Anthony Bologna's personal information found by the hacker group Anonymous. Name, Anthony V. Baloney. Phone 518-989-9051. Lives at number 5 Sawyer Avenue, presumably in New York. Repeat. Name, Anthony V. Baloney. Phone 518-989-9051. Lives at number 5 Sawyer Avenue, presumably in New York. None of this police brutality and just plain baloney has been able to stop protests. Despite the brutality you just heard, despite buckets of rain last week, police attacks triggered by using tarps to protect equipment, and over $1,000 worth of electronics destroyed by, quote, rain concrete cops, protesters are still out there, Wall Street is still occupied, and the banksters still have to show ID to pass through the massive police barricades and get into the stock exchange. The published schedule for Occupy Wall Street extends at least to March 2012, and the protesters show no signs of giving up. As long as Liberty Square is occupied, as long as protesters stage marches on the Wall Street perimeter, the New York cops have to keep up the baloney at the checkpoints, and that has got to be bad for a stock trader's psychology. Their number one worry is that Greece, Portugal, and Ireland will default on their so-called debts under pressure from protesters. Having to run the gauntlet of both protesters and police barricades just to get to the stock exchange has got to be a strong reminder of that probability. Is it any wonder the stock exchange had their worst week in 3 years last week? Occupy Wall Street will go on. The banksters making billions in untaxed cash and bonuses will not.
In the months after the near collapse of the U.S. financial and banking system in 2008 that triggered the most serious global economic meltdown since the Great Depression, America has witnessed an uneasy silence, suggesting either trauma or stunned acquiescence. While polls find that the population at large blames the recklessness of wealthy bankers and speculators for record unemployment and home foreclosures, the only real anger expressed in the streets in recent years has come from corporate-backed Tea Party activists bent on defunding social safety net programs while labeling President Obama a Muslim socialist and attacking unions. With the exception of public sector labor unions that were forced to mobilize in Wisconsin and Ohio after Republican governors in those states attempted to eliminate labor's collective bargaining rights, the U.S. left has remained largely quiet, with little in the way of protests focused on demanding accountability for those that crashed the economy. But on September 17th, the near silence was broken when several hundred mostly young activists executed a long-planned peaceful occupation of Wall Street, setting up an encampment near the New York Stock Exchange in Zuccotti Park, a space they renamed Liberty Plaza. Despite mass arrests and clear cases of unprovoked physical abuse at the hands of police, the activists on Wall Street continue their occupation. Activists there are daily engaged in an open-air dialogue to agree on a unified set of demands. But what brought them together was a common anger at a system where jobs and homes disappeared while stockbrokers and CEOs got rich, even as no bankers have gone to jail for their economic crimes. The Wall Street action has spawned support nationwide, with nearly 50 groups forming overnight, with plans to engage in similar occupations in their own cities. Your reporter spoke with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges, who recently visited Liberty Plaza to express his support. Here he explains why he believes that the occupation of Wall Street and similar militant actions are the only hope for America.
People are doing something, that they're rising up against this corrupt financial system that has seized control not only of our economy and our political process, but our judiciary and the systems of information, and are dismantling everything that we have in place to create a neo-feudalistic society, looting the U.S. Treasury, trashing the ecosystem. In theological terms, these are systems of death because they know no limit. Karl Marx was right. Unfettered capitalism is a revolutionary force which turns everything into a commodity. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that you exploit until exhaustion or collapse. And because there are no impediments within the formal structures of power, unless we begin to engage in acts of civil disobedience, we will not thwart the destruction that is being unleashed by corporate power. So is this the spark? I don't know. I hope so. But if this isn't the spark is coming, because I think an increasing number of Americans are waking up to the fact that we've been had.
Chris, we have seen a succession of legislation in Washington, D.C. that many characterize as tepid and mostly just fig leaf attempts at reforming the financial system that imploded on us a few years ago and really put so much wealth down a black hole. As people look at what's going on in terms of the loss of their wealth, their homes, their jobs, are people prepared for something more than just papered over tepid reform? Are they really looking, or do you think people are really ready for some substantial restructuring of our system here, both in terms of politics and economics?
There has been no restraint of the criminal activity of Wall Street. Companies like Goldman Sachs engaged in clear fraud. They sold subprime mortgages to people they knew could not pay it back, and then repackaged this stuff as assets, betting against it through AIG. I mean, it's completely fraudulent and criminal behavior. And the taxpayer, courtesy of Geithner and Bernanke and Paulson and others, bails them out for everything that they lost, everything AIG lost, $170 billion. And the only person who goes to jail is Bernie Madoff, because, of course, he steals from rich people. It's a pretty staggering state of affairs. And not only has Wall Street not in any way been regulated, not only have they orchestrated the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, but they've gone back to playing exactly the same games they played before. In the 17th century, speculators were hung. Speculation was a crime. It was a capital crime. And in 21st century America, they run the government.
Chris, what are the connections you see between what's unfolding in downtown New York City right now with the occupation of Wall Street and the protests we've seen, change regimes in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, and certainly the massive protests we've seen across Europe in places like Athens and Madrid? We've also, of course, seen a lot of a response to the attacks on unionism in Wisconsin and Ohio. What are the connections you see?
The similarity between this protest and the ones in the Arab world is that they're young. Most of these kids are in their 20s. They are primarily white, well-educated men and women who did everything right, got out and finished with their university degrees, and realized there was no place for them within the economy at all, that they'd been had. And I think that that is a similar kind of anger that we saw in Europe, are seen in Europe and throughout the Arab world. And the other similarity is that they're very tech-savvy. I mean, they have a sort of ad hoc media center where, as the Egyptian organizers did, they're very careful about recording what happens to them. And the police brutality on Saturday night was quite severe, but they caught it all with their cameras and put it out over the Internet where people can see it. And I think a lot of people were pretty shocked at how brutal the New York City police were in terms of their treatment of peaceful protesters who had not violated any laws, pepper spraying young women until they were screaming and were blind, handcuffing people and then knocking them off their feet so that they fall face down on the asphalt, pounding their heads into the ground. It was pretty amazing scenes. And I encourage all of your listeners to go to either Adbusters, the website, or Occupy Wall Street, and take a look at it, because it's very disturbing stuff. And I think that that's a window into how frightened the power elite is. On some level, either subconscious or overtly, they have to realize that 99% of Americans are being fleeced by these corporate leviathans. And should that consciousness spread outwards quickly, then the power elite is in big, big trouble. And I hope it does. And I hope this is the movement that does it.
Chris, what advice do you have for the young people and everyone else who's attracted to these long-term actions with serious consequences for the participants? What advice?
Well, this is all we have left, that the system is broken. It doesn't work. Civil disobedience is the only mechanism we have by which we can affect change. And if we don't use it, if we remain complacent and passive, things are only going to worse and worse and worse. Social networking is very useful in terms of communication. It's useless in terms of activism. The only way to carry out meaningful action and affect change is finally with your bodies. And if you can get to Liberty Plaza in New York, get there. And there's talk now of occupying financial zones in cities like Chicago and San Francisco. Now is not the time to remain complacent.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author Chris Hedges. His latest book is titled The World as It Is. Visit our Between the Lines website to learn more about the Occupy Wall Street action.
Yesterday, nearly 2,000 people showed up to hear Dr. Cornel West at Occupy Wall Street, where protesters are holding a nearby park now renamed Freedom Square and holding regular marches on Wall Street. On the 20th of September, I received a robotic survey call from the Consumer Energy Alliance. They started with two questions, quote, do you believe gas prices are too high? And quote, do you believe unemployment is too high? Recognizing that this had to be a fake industry push-pull, I answered no to both questions, even though Wall Street has indeed thrown far too many people out of work. I then managed to start recording the rest of this phony so-called survey, microphone to telephone. Turns out the whole survey is about pressuring the Department of State to approve that nasty tar sands oil pipeline that 1,250 people were arrested in front of the White House saying no to. Here's what my microphone got.
U.S. dependence on imports from the Middle East. To build this importing pipeline, TransCanada must receive a permit from the Department of State that will allow it to cross the border from Canada to the U.S. The Department of State is currently soliciting public comments on whether to grant the permit and allow TransCanada to build the pipeline and put thousands of Americans to work. May we have your permission to relay your support for this vital pipeline?
No, you may not. I oppose the pipeline, and I wish the project would be blocked.
Please say yes.
No.
Repeat. Now.
No.
Would you like more information on
no.
oil and gas production and the jobs that it can create?
No.
Are you male?
Yes.
Are you 50 years of age or older?
No.
Thank you for your time and views. This survey was conducted by the Consumer Energy Alliance. Goodbye. 7 months.
I should have gotten the recording more quickly.
It looks to me like the Consumer Energy Alliance is desperate to keep alive our bad romance with fossil fuels and dirty oil. No, I wasn't going to let them falsely tell the Department of State that I support the filthy Alberta tar sands mining. I'd rather see gasoline cost $10 a gallon and support a pipeline whose contributions to global warming is going to flood every coastal city, including mine. On the 25th of September, Brian Maloney, an executive of AstraZeneca, a customer of puppet-killing Huntington Life Sciences, got another protest at his upscale home in D.C. Again, someone came out of the building to claim he doesn't live there. Again, they presented no evidence, even after a person fitting Brian Maloney's description was seen at an earlier protest screaming and yelling. And this time, someone even assaulted a photographer.
Brian Maloney! We are here at the Latrobe building because Brian Maloney works at AstraZeneca, which is a top customer of Huntington Life Sciences.
More in the back.
It's a contract animal testing facility that monitors 500 animals each and every day of the week for people like Brian Maloney and AstraZeneca. Brian Maloney has issued global issues management at AstraZeneca, so he has the power to cut the price ties with Huntington Life Sciences. And to the manager of our trove, if you have any documentation supporting your claim for our son, then we have
Just something about having three or four horns going off outside your apartment that generates incredible pressure from the neighbors. Here come the lies with a neighbor claiming Brian Maloney doesn't live there, even though his name is on the call box, it connects to his phone answering machine, and a person fitting his description has been seen at the building.
Yeah, he really, really doesn't because...
Why is his name on the call box? Why is his name on the call box? That was a sound of a camera being punched by that same woman who was lying about Brian Maloney not living there. Shortly thereafter, about 10 cops showed up from the International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings, but they didn't do anything. And here's an interview in which protesters lay down the evidence that Brian Maloney does, in fact, still live in the Latrobe.
In the morning, at a morning demonstration, a neighbor who looked like who resembled, fit the description of Brian Maloney, was coming out yelling, being very passionate. And
he fits all the description in terms of hair color and weight, that kind of stuff?
Everything, yeah. So we're just waiting to confirm that it was actually him.
And we also have his name on the call box, right?
Yes.
So all the evidence, just a person fitting the description who is very angry, name on the call box, calling the call box, connects to Brian Maloney's telephone, says either he lives there or there's a very strong business relationship between Brian Maloney and the Latrobe, and why would he have been there on the day a hurricane
Saturday
was coming and, unless he lived there?
Yeah, exactly. He was definitely... He was there, and he came out with a person that has been out at every single one of the protests.
So there's something fishy going on at the Latrobe.
Yeah, and that something fishy smells like Huntington Life Sciences, Brian Maloney, and AstraZeneca sending money to Huntington Life Sciences. Brian Maloney, if you want an end to these protests, you know what to do. Stop sending money to puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences, where 500 animals are killed every day testing products like bleach and Splenda.
In a new investigative report, the humanitarian group No More Deaths says the U.S. Border Patrol routinely abuses migrants from Latin America who are detained in the desert of southern Arizona. The report, titled A Culture of Cruelty, reviewed 30,000 incidents in Arizona and found that migrants suffering from severe dehydration were denied water by border agents, people with serious medical conditions were not provided care while in custody, and children and adults were beaten by border agents. Since 2000, over 2,100 migrants have died attempting to cross the Arizona desert from Mexico. The high number of annual deaths is the result of tight security in Texas and California, which has pushed migrants to find a route through Arizona's desert. Border control agents have prevented immigrant supporters from placing containers of water in the desert that could save hundreds of lives. According to the Arizona chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, on any given day, 3,000 undocumented immigrants are held in federal detention centers in Arizona. The detainees are not only migrants crossing the border, but many people living in the U.S. with their families and arrested during routine traffic stops. In their report, No More Deaths found U.S. agents used harsh interrogation techniques, including sleep deprivation, keeping detainees in cells at extremely hot or cold temperatures, and forcing prisoners into painful positions while in detention. Many of these practices fall within the international definition of torture,